Better and Longer with the Fitness Show, hosted by fitness expert, author, and TV personality, Fitz Kohler. She'll tell you why diets are dumb, supplements are snake oil, and the truth about how you can earn a lean, hard, pain-free, and athletic body. Now for our favorite bossy blonde, Fitz Kohler.
Hi team, I'm Fitz Kohler, your very noisy race announcer and fitness expert from fitness.com, and welcome to the Fitness Show. It's October and everybody's thinking pink, and unfortunately pink is going to be a part of my stupid world forever, but that's okay. But I know we want to talk about breast cancer, and sometimes we talk about it and people are throwing out ideas that maybe aren't true. Maybe some of them are great ideas, but I have a friend. She's a guest, but she's also a friend I'm super excited to have. She's a runner, and we got to spend some time together at the Falmouth Road Race, and I really like her. And besides being a runner and an overall nice gal, she is a breast cancer oncologist at Mass General Hospital Cancer Center, and she's also the director of breast cancer oncology there and of cancer survivorship. So she has a lot to offer. Oh, by the way, she's also an instructor at Harvard Med School. So the fancy credentials could go on forever, but know this, she knows her stuff, and she has your best interest in mind. So let's bring on Dr. Amy Commander.
Hi, so happy to join you.
Yeah, last time we were together, we were in this beautiful house in Cape Cod.
That was super fun. It was so awesome to have you as the race announcer for the Falmouth Road Race, which is my second favorite race in Massachusetts each year.
And your first?
I think you know that has to be the Boston Marathon, but Falmouth is right after that.
How many times have you run Boston?
I've run it 10 times each year for charity. I will acknowledge I am not one of those amazing qualified runners, but I truly love it. And it's the best day here in Boston. So it's been an honor to run it for the past 10 years.
Yeah. And what causes do you run for?
The past few years, I've been honored to run for the Ellie Fund, which is a nonprofit organization here in Massachusetts, really dedicated to providing supportive care to individuals diagnosed with breast cancer in this state, regardless of financial need. And that can include transportation to appointments, childcare, assistance with groceries, you name it. So it's been such an honor to run to support that important cause.
Yeah, that's impressive. I ran for charity. I ran for Second Step. It's a domestic violence segue type program. And how many athletes will say, oh, I would never run Boston unless I qualified. And I feel like, really, you wouldn't be part of, I think it's a $40 million day for charities. It's pretty impactful. Why would you reject that goodness along with the opportunity to have such a wonderful experience, right?
I fully agree. It's so rewarding to run for a cause that you're passionate about. And there are so many runners on the Boston Marathon Day, you know, supporting various causes that are important to them. So I 100% agree with you.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So listen, we're going to talk about breast cancer, but before we do, I have a couple of questions so people can get to know you a little better. What is the one song you would listen to on repeat over and over and over if you could only listen to one song during a marathon? And you can't say, I don't listen to music when I run.
Oh my goodness, that is so funny. Well, I have to give a shout out to my daughter who's now 16, but for the past few years, she's always made me a playlist for the marathon. Somehow it's always like the day before. I'm like, oh, I need a new playlist. And she is so cute and puts it together for me. And gosh, I have to think about that. You know, I love so many different songs, but I'm just going to tell you what's coming to mind because it has helped me on those heartbreak hills. As you know, it's not just one hill, it's a series of hills. But I love that song, This Girl Is On Fire. So that's helped me. But I love many songs. What about you? What would you say?
Oh gosh, Garth Brooks, Call Him Baton Rouge. Makes me feel rowdy, and he's my favorite. It would be that or Ludacris, Get Back, which is pretty vulgar, but either way, they're both probably Garth Brooks. Okay, now your favorite thing to indulge in after the marathon.
Ooh, after the marathon. Mm-hmm. Wow. It's so funny. I don't know what you think, but sometimes when I get home, I know I need to eat, but sometimes it's just so hard to like feel like eating. Like, even though obviously I know that's what's important to do. I'd say the past few years, my family has brought home so I'm vegetarian, but I love sushi, like avocado rolls and other interesting vegetarian sushi rolls. So that's what they've done for me. And that seems to hit the spot, but I don't usually have a huge appetite after I finish the race. Do you?
No. You know what I wanted after Boston? I wanted salty French fries and Diet Coke, and I got neither. We went to the only place on earth that had no French fries and no Diet Coke. So, but that's okay. But those are my wish. Okay, now your first Hollywood crush.
Oh my goodness, gee. Oh gosh. Well, I remember as a teenager loving that movie. Oh my goodness, was it Say Anything?
Yes.
And who was that actor? Forgive me.
John Cusack.
Yes. I love that scene. So I know. So it's funny, but if you have to ask me, that's what comes to mind.
Okay. That's a great choice. And then the final question is, what's your favorite book?
Ooh, favorite book. Wow. Gosh, I have so many books I love. It's really hard for me to find a favorite book. I have to be honest with you, but, and I usually have a stack of them right next to me of all the books I'm reading right now. Can I just highlight a book I'm reading now that I really
love?
Because it's hard for me to come up with one favorite. I know we're both really interested in lifestyle medicine and steps we can take to optimize health. And so I'm currently reading that book, Outlive, by Dr. Peter Attia, which is really focused on longevity and evidence-based tips we can incorporate into our own lives to improve our health and well-being and potentially longevity. So I do really like that. I'm kind of a nerd, you know that, but I love fiction books too. It's just hard for me to pick one to list as my favorite.
That's fair. But I love how you said evidence-based, because
that's
so important, right? And we're going to talk about a lot of evidence-based stuff. So what made you choose breast cancer oncology to focus on?
Great question. When I ended up deciding to focus on oncology during my fellowship, which is after residency, which is after medical school, we have the opportunity to care for patients with all different types of diseases. And I really found the whole science of oncology fascinating, but I found that I really bonded so well with my patients with breast cancer. It wasn't that I didn't like taking care of men. And by the way, men can get breast cancer too. So certainly I have some male patients as well, but I just had such close connections and meaningful relationships with my patients with breast cancer. And it seemed like just a natural fit for me. So that's how I ended up in that particular area.
And do you not see leukemia or brain cancer, or do you exclusively see breast?
So when I'm, working in the hospital on call, I do care for patients with all different types of cancer. And I do consults for any hematologic or oncology problem. I am board certified in hematology and oncology. So I'm capable of doing that, but my outpatient practice is focused just on breast cancer.
Okay. And how many active patients do you have right now?
A lot. I can't even answer that. I mean it. Like, I actually don't even know. But
do you think it's like 50 or 300?
My goodness. Active meaning, some of our patients, of course, are in chemo. Some are on anti-estrogen therapy. Some are on immunotherapies, targeted therapies. I mean, I would say in terms of active patients on treatment, it's definitely in the hundreds right now. Yeah.
Wow. So what do we have in common, us gals who show up, who have just been diagnosed? When we come into your office, what is the number one thing you see in most of us?
Well, what I see in all of my patients is the desire to be cured and do well and have a good quality of life. And that is definitely something that I try to work with all of my patients to help them achieve that and feel empowered after their diagnosis for what steps they can take to ensure the best possible outcome.
So they say it's 1 in 8 women in North America, and then 94% of breast cancer cases are curable. Is that the accurate number?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's 1 in 8 cases. And unfortunately, I think it's estimated that it'll be close to 300,000 individuals diagnosed with breast cancer this year in the United States.
Wow. And then what gives you the most confidence in treating us?
Well, I'm personally, I went into this field because I was also very interested in the science, of course, and I can tell you that there have been tremendous strides in research in breast cancer over these past few years. I mean, even since I started at Mass General, a little over 10 or 11 years ago, there have been such amazing strides in terms of treatment. So that gives me so much hope, and I certainly try to instill that in my patients as well, that we continue to find better treatments and also ways to you perhaps pull back on some treatments that may not be necessary so we can kind of avoid some of the potential side effects and potentially long-term complications from treatment.
Yeah. Now, as far as studies go, is there anything very specific recently that thrills you, that gets you so excited? What is that?
Right. Well, just to give one example, one type of breast cancer that occurs, it's probably about 15% of breast cancers that we see in this country. It's the more aggressive type. It's called triple negative breast cancer. And one area of great interest is using our immunotherapy drugs to treat cancer. And immunotherapy means drugs that help enhance the immune system's ability to fight off a cancer. And we found that these drugs actually are very effective in treatment of this aggressive subtype of breast cancer. So I just like having more tools in my toolkit to offer my patients who have, for example, a more aggressive subtype of breast cancer.
And then I've been told, I believe it's Mayo Clinic, they're working on a vaccination for if you've already had triple negative breast cancer, they can give you a vaccination and you're less likely to have a recurrence. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's just another really exciting example of harnessing the immune system to fight a patient's tumor. And we had that trial open at the Mass General Cancer Center as well. And I'm really excited to learn more about that once we have more data.
That's fantastic. Any chance that there will be some sort of chemo drug that won't steal our hair?
Well, that's been a really exciting development just in the past few years that we've been able to offer, certainly at our cancer center, and also, you know, many places throughout the world using scalp cooling to help prevent hair loss. I will say it does not work with every type of chemotherapy, but with some chemotherapy agents, it can work really well. And that's been a game changer. But I know it doesn't work with every drug. So hopefully over time, we'll have more effective methods. So for example, with drugs like adriamycin, we have a better chance of preventing hair loss. Because I know when I talk to my patients, that's like number one up there in terms of concerns, like, really, I'm going to lose my hair. And I feel so bad about that for patients who are receiving some drugs that where the scalp cooling is not as effective. But it has been amazingly effective for certain types of drugs that we use.
Yeah, when I was on my path to starting treatment, which was very quickly, they got me going really quickly, because the cancer was spreading really quickly. But it was maybe the Friday before I started treatment on Monday. I called the nurse and I said, hey, can I do that cold capping thing? I just heard about it. She said, we're just not really set up yet. And it takes a few weeks to get it ordered or whatever. So I just thought, forget it. I'll just deal with it. But I have so many friends who have been able to maintain the great majority of their hair. Now, some people think there's a risk because those scalp cells are being frozen, that they're not being affected by the chemotherapy. Is there any chance your breast cancer is going to spread to your scalp and then survive because it was cool?
We think that risk is exceedingly low. I mean, studies suggest that the use of the scalp cooling is effective and safe, but certainly we discuss the risk and benefit with each of our patients. But I'm sorry I didn't get to take advantage of it, because it is for certain individuals, obviously it's a major game changer.
Absolutely.
So your hair looks awesome now.
It's so nice to have hair. Look at that.
Yay!
Someone compliments me on my hair and I just say it's great to have hair. Forget the rest. I have some. So what do you wish more women and men, breast cancer patients, I'll just say, who showed up to see you, what do you wish they knew? Like, what do you wish was common knowledge amongst most people, so when they came to you, they weren't XYZ?
Yeah, well, I find, and I'm interested in your perspective on this as well, many of my patients, when they, you know, when I get to know them, somehow they think it's something they did that caused the breast cancer. Like, oh, I was eating too much red meat, or I was drinking too much alcohol, or I was such a couch potato, and that's why I got this, or I missed my mammogram over the years of the pandemic. And I think it's really important to just take all that away. Do not blame yourself. Do not feel guilty. There are so many factors that can contribute to a risk for breast cancer, many of which we don't fully understand. And therefore, I really think I try to work with my patients that address that, because I feel like that feeling of shame and guilt is so counterproductive, not helpful. And really, you know, it is not a person's fault that they got cancer. And I just think that's really important to emphasize.
So, and I agree that the blame game is not a good choice. However, are there some things that people can do to lower their risk? So I've read the studies and I've seen some studies that say there are things we can do to lower the risk. So what are those things? What should people start avoiding or doing more of?
Definitely. Great question. You know, this is an area I'm super interested in. So we do know that there are aspects of our lifestyle that we can change after a cancer diagnosis. Certainly that can improve health, improve ability to tolerate treatment, reduce side effects, and ultimately improve outcome from a diagnosis of breast cancer. And for example, I know we're both passionate about this, exercise. Many studies have shown immense benefits of exercise in terms of reducing risk of recurrence and also improving outcomes. So that is certainly a key message I try to convey to my patients. And that's really an opportunity where an individual can feel empowered, like, wow, I can start, you know, embracing physical activity, which is an important component of my treatment. And so that's key. And I know you have done such groundbreaking work in this area too. So I'd love to hear your perspective as well.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, obviously the studies are endless, and you and I don't speak we're not guessing. It's right. Factual. That's factual. That exercise, you really do have so much power to affect your outcomes. It's interesting for someone like me, because people will say, well, you exercise your whole life and you still got cancer in it. Okay. That's true, but there are babies in the hospital that have cancer and they did nothing. So the blaming doesn't help. But I also look back and I think, well, I did drink a lot of alcohol in college. I spent the first 20 years of my life eating beef and processed foods, and perhaps they did impact this outcome. And I'm not going to beat myself up over it, but, you know, are there behaviors that if I could go back and undo, I would? Perhaps. I mean, do you think someone now, if they changed and gave up the processed meats and lowered their alcohol consumption, they could lower their risk of cancers?
Well, we do know that lifestyle factors can account for a significant percentage of an individual's risk for cancer. But we also know there are many other factors, genetic factors, environmental factors, so many factors based on exposures from when we're born and go through childhood, adolescence, adulthood. So I think it's super complicated. It really is the holy grail to understand, like, why did this person get cancer, right? So that's why I try to use this as an opportunity with my patients. It's sort of like a teachable moment. Okay, now that you have this diagnosis, what can we do to move forward, to do everything we can to help optimize your health, obviously help prevent other chronic diseases, and help reduce the risk of experiencing recurrence? So I think, you know, it's just kind of put those thoughts aside and move forward. And I know that's an important part of your work as well.
Now, who is the oldest patient you've ever had come in diagnosed?
Oh, I have patients in their late 90s. And they're like amazing. I'm thinking of one lovely lady who I saw pretty recently, and I'm always like, tell me your secret. And this particular lovely patient of mine is also the most fashionable and the best dressed in the clinic. And I love that she still goes shopping and is super passionate about that. So I love my patients in their 90s. But age, of course, being a woman and getting older are your two, you know, top risk factors for breast cancer. So it happens, right? But I do love my patients who are, you know, who in that age range. It's just so fun to talk to them.
I bet. And then who is the youngest, or how old is the youngest person you've seen diagnosed?
So that's obviously pretty tough. Numerous recent studies are showing that there unfortunately is an increasing incidence of breast cancer in younger women, certainly under age 50. And so, I mean, just this week, I saw a new patient who's 36 years old. That's not my youngest by any means, but certainly the treatment plan and conversations you have with a younger woman are very different than those that you have with an older patient. So many other considerations must come into play. So it is very challenging. And certainly, you know, researchers, certainly in my area and across the world, are trying to figure out why are we potentially seeing this bump in breast cancer risk in younger women.
Yeah. What's the number? What's the youngest person?
I would say probably the youngest patient I've had was, I think, 28.
Okay.
Actually, maybe a little younger than that, but, you know, it's thankfully
rare.
A diagnosis in the 20s is quite rare, but certainly we do see it.
Okay. So once someone's diagnosed and they start treatment, what do you wish they would do? Like, what, it could be anything from leisure activities to ways to prevent or minimize nausea. What are some pointers that people don't hear all the time that you would like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think, and I know I'll be interested in your thoughts on this too. I think having your, you know, medical team is key. So having a team that you work well with, that you feel listens to you, and that team might include medical oncologists, a surgeon, radiation oncologist, and all the wonderful team players, you know, that we have, like our physical therapist, our registered dietitian, nurse practitioner, you name it. We have such a great team. Finding your medical team is key, but also your support team, who's going to help you get through that treatment. And that might be, you know, your best friend. That might be, you know, your partner. That might be your parent, whoever that may be. Having that support team is so key, and identifying that early on and not being afraid to ask for help. I think that's so important. And I always tell my patients, when you're getting help from someone, remember that person feels good too, because they're helping you and they want to support you. So I think it's okay to get help, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I totally agreed. And I think there's a point where you don't have any choice. So I think my first hurdle came when, you know, I couldn't cook food because I was sick, and then I couldn't drive my children safely. And so at that point, I realized, okay, I have to accept help, which I don't like accepting help. However, I decided, okay, I will rectify this with myself by doing everything I can moving forward to help others. I will just pay it forward. And
you do
equal the playing field, right? Does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great strategy for sure. So I'm glad that you did let yourself get help, because it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, I really agonize for the people who can't, who don't have families, or how do you do cancer alone?
Right. Agree.
Really, really tough stuff. So you see a lot of hardship. I'm sure you see a lot of tears. What are some of the best things you experience with your patients?
Well, you know, now I see my patients, you know, after 5 years, we continue to see our patients at least once a year. I mean, some of them still like to come twice a year, but, you know, just this week, I saw some of my patients who I've known for like 10 years. Cause, you know, I've been at Mass General for now, I think 11-ish years. So it's like, they're like friends now. It's like catching up with an old friend. So it's funny. Like sometimes I tell a story to my kids and they're like, do you actually talk about cancer with your patients? But some of them are like old friends now. So I just love, you know, knowing what this individual has gone through, you know, to get to this point, but seeing them do so well and all the amazing things they're doing in their life. It's just so rewarding. I'll tell a fun story, actually. A patient I saw yesterday who I've known now for 6 years, when she was first diagnosed, she and her husband were planning on going on a cruise around the world. Okay. Wow. I'm not kidding. Around the world. It was like a 8-month cruise. Okay. And sadly, they needed to defer it because she needed chemotherapy and she wanted to obviously put her health first. Right. Yeah. So they did defer it. And then the pandemic happened. Okay. So they couldn't do their cruise around the world. But when I saw her yesterday, they had recently gotten back from this amazing experience. And so they told me all about it. And it sounded so cool. And I'm like, sign me up. I totally want to do that someday. But I'm just so happy for them that they got to take advantage of this incredible experience. And she's feeling great, by the way.
That's fantastic. What are some of the most interesting things you've seen women do with their hair in place of hair? The whole hair debacle, what have you seen and you thought, wow, that's cool?
Oh, I have a great answer I immediately thought of when you asked that question. So another one of my dear patients who's a lot of fun, you know, she knew she was going to lose her hair. This was definitely before we had the scalp cooling. She always wanted pink hair. She just wanted it, okay? And she had never taken the plunge because, you know, she just didn't know what people would think, whatever. So before she lost her hair, she dyed it bright pink. And it was super cool and super awesome. She loved it. Of course, she did unfortunately lose her pink hair, but she's so glad she did it. And I just love that she did that.
That's really great. Now, I had a friend, she had leukemia, and she did this incredible photo shoot. While her hair started to come out, and it was her in a black turtleneck, and she did all these different interesting hairstyles. The stylist cut it short. They cut it one way and they took some pictures and then they cut it. It was phenomenal. She eventually ended up with this really cool mohawk and then they shaved that up too. But
awesome.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, I love that.
All right. And now I'm going to go to the hard part. So not everybody survives. How do you deal with that? I mean, quite often if I'm at my oncologist and he's not in the room right away, I just think, oh no, maybe he's giving horrible news to somebody. Or how do you do that? And how does that work?
It is really hard. I will fully acknowledge it's super hard. And that part of the job, I hate to say it, does not get any easier. And if that were ever to be the case, then I know I shouldn't be doing this any longer, because it's so hard. And I get to know my patients and their families really well. I mean, our whole team does. And so it's always so sad to lose a patient. What can I say? And I mean, I often try to follow up with the family after I lose a patient, you know, maybe a few weeks later to check in, see how they're doing, offer support. And for me, that call is also very therapeutic, but I will say that it's really hard. What can I say? And I always do my best. So, you know, to make feel like all my patients have the best possible chance to live as long as they can with the best possible quality of life, but it's certainly very difficult.
Yeah. What goes into that is I always hear about the multiple doctors talking about the patient and deciding what are factors that go into when you just decide we can't treat them anymore?
Right. I mean, so many factors. I'm also fortunate at the Mass General Cancer Center and many places we have, you know, palliative care colleagues who really help our patients and us, you know, navigate these difficult times as well. But I think it's always really important to, you know, assess an individual's goals when it comes to their care. You know, people have different goals. For example, getting back to this hair topic, you know, I had a patient with advanced breast cancer who really needed to be on a different chemo regimen. And she just told me, like, Dr. Commander, whatever you do, I do not want to lose my hair. Like, it was kind of near the end. And that was so important to her. And so therefore we did not switch to a different drug, because the rest of the drugs, unfortunately, potentially could cause that, right? So I think it's really important. Certainly as a doctor, I try to make sure I'm taking my patients' wishes into account. And, you know, some people might say, though, give me whatever you have. I don't care what the side effects are. So these are very, you know, complicated ongoing conversations with a patient and with the family, of course.
Now, are those occasions where someone passes from breast cancer, is it rare?
I mean, remember, I'm kind of at a tertiary care hospital where we see patients with, you know, a lot of them who come to see us may have an aggressive subtype of breast cancer, and it may already be an advanced stage. So, so it's, you know, it's not really rare for me, but like, certainly, as we stated at the beginning of this conversation, you know, cure rates for breast cancer are certainly increasing. And thankfully, for many subtypes of breast cancer, the prognosis is very, very good.
Yeah. Yeah. So going back to survival, which we like talking about that way better. There's the real side, though, and I appreciate you going there with me. What percentage of your patients find their own lump versus mammogram?
Great question. I would say the majority of my patients have their breast cancers detected on a screening mammogram. Certainly, some will find a lump themselves, and that will bring them to medical attention. But the screening mammogram leads to the majority of new diagnoses.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I found my own lump. It's fascinating to think people are just going in for a regular appointment, and then that doctor says, you know what, stick around a minute. Let's have another look-see, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what percentage of your patients are diagnosed really early on?
Like early stage diagnoses?
Yeah.
The majority of the patients that I see, thankfully, have early stage disease, which means it is curable. So that is obviously a good thing.
That is fantastic. So moving still even further in the bright side, what wonderful things have you seen breast cancer patients do during treatment that just blew your mind?
People are always so kind. And I'll just tell you another anecdote from a patient I spoke to earlier today. I feel like people are always thinking of others, you know, the nurses and everyone else in the hospital who's running around all day, maybe not even taking 2 minutes for lunch. And so my patient I spoke to earlier today, she said, I want to bring bagels for the whole team. How many people are there? And I'm like, I have no idea. There's a lot. So she's like bringing in 3 dozen bagels on Monday, and so kind and so sweet and so thoughtful. So I feel like it's just such a gift to do this work and to witness such kindness all the time. And so, by the way, if you're listening to this, you do not need to bring food to your medical team. We do actually have food, but it's just an example of such a nice gesture that's really unexpected.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about athletic things? What have you seen people going through chemo and radiation and surgery? What kind of physical triumphs?
Oh gosh, I know we could talk about this for a whole episode. I'm always inspired by my patients and the amazing things they do. And just to tell another fun anecdote, I know you know about this program I run called Paving the Path to Wellness for Breast Cancer Survivors. And in a recent group, there was a woman in her 40s and another woman in her 70s. And both of them just stated, wow, I just started this program at my YMCA called Livestrong, which is a free exercise program for cancer survivors. So they were like, you know, they connected in that way and then started going to Livestrong together. And then once that program ended, they stayed in touch and started to go to the gym together to kind of keep the momentum going. And now those two women are like really good friends. Okay. Again, one's in her 40s, one is in her 70s. They never would have really connected, you know, otherwise. One's a grandmother, one has kids that are like 9-11. And I just love that they'll send me a picture sometimes. We're having lunch together today, and it just warms my heart. So that's just another, I could tell so many stories, but that's a fun one that just comes to mind.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet. Yeah, there's all these silver linings, and we would be, I mean, it just would be really ignorant not to acknowledge them and appreciate them. I mean, no one wants cancer, but I don't think it's even on occasion. I think there's a whole lot of goodness that comes out of this very weird experience.
I hear you. I agree. Nobody wants cancer, but there definitely are some good things that potentially come from it for sure.
So advice for someone who loves a cancer patient.
Again, I know we're both runners, and I'm sure you're a fan of Des Linden, just yep. like I am. And I love one of her slogans, keep showing up. So that certainly applies to running races. And if you're trying to run the Boston Marathon one day, maybe that would help. But also it applies to supporting your loved ones. Keep showing up. And I try to tell my kids this all the time. Like, actions mean more than words. Showing up. Bringing food to that person, helping, as you said, with maybe driving somewhere, walking someone's dog, just doing acts of kindness that really support another person really means so much. And so I think that's a key message I like to convey.
Yeah, that's invaluable, because to be honest with you, it's really hard to ask for help. But if somebody just shows up and mows your lawn,
yeah,
or a dish or whatever, that means you don't even have to argue about. They just do it, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so not only do you have all of these impressive credentials that we spoke about at the beginning, but you're also co-author of Paving the Path to Wellness workbook. What do people need to know about this big, beautiful book by three beautiful women?
Well, I do, of course, thank you so much. And I want to talk about your books too. I will say it was such an honor to co-author this book along with Dr. Beth Frates and Dr. Michelle Tollefson. And really each chapter, there's many chapters, but it's really focused on the 12 topics that we cover in the Paving the Path to Wellness program, which I worked with Dr. Frates to adapt for breast cancer survivors or thrivers, as they like to call themselves. And so we work through, you know, many of the topics that are key for lifestyle medicine, such as physical activity, nutrition, sleep, stress management, social connection. I could go on and on. We have some additional topics too, but there is a quote I love at the beginning of our book that I think you would love as well. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And that's from Lao Tzu, the ancient Chinese philosopher. So I really encourage my patients to think about that. You just need to take the first step when you're trying to make a change in terms of maybe it's your diet or your exercise habits or your sleep habits. We're all starting somewhere at different places. So, and we all have opportunities to grow. So that's really a key message of the program. So thank you for asking about it.
Of course, it's a big, beautiful book, and it's so valuable. It's an actual workbook, folks. So invest in yourself, and they can get that on Amazon, I'm guessing.
Correct. And from Healthy Learning, our publisher. And I just have to tell the story. So when we got to meet in Falmouth at the Falmouth Road Race afterwards at my friend's house, I got to give you a copy of this book and you gave me your book. So let's give you a shout out too. It was so fun.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The support I've been given by oncologists has been very meaningful.
Thank you so much. Such a great resource.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So what else? Is there anything else you'd like people to know before I cut you loose and let you go save more lives?
Oh, wow. Well, this has been such a fun conversation, and I certainly want to thank you for your inspiration. You kind of know now I'm into like fun, inspiring quotes. And actually before I joined you on this podcast, I was like cleaning up some stuff in my kitchen, and I have this calendar with all these fun quotes on it. So I'm going to share the one. It did resonate with me. So I bet you'll like this one too. And I don't know this author. This quote is from Hilary DePiana, but it says, "We all get the exact same 365 days. The only difference is what we do with them." So I love that. And I know you and I have so many shared interests and goals to help cancer survivors thrive. And it's been such an honor to join you for this conversation.
Well, you are a doll, Amy. And I'm so happy we are friends. Dr. Amy Commander. And she's also Dr. Amy Commander on Instagram. And she posts a ton of fantastic content, whether you love running or you're going through any sort of cancer. You're very uplifting and helpful. You have a useful page.
Thank you. And yours is too. I appreciate that.
Okay. So, and are you going to come run the Donna this year?
I know. So I will just tell the listeners, we had so much fun hanging out in Falmouth, and you told us about that amazing race in February in Jacksonville, the Donna Marathon to support breast cancer. So it is on my calendar, and I just need to like take the plunge and buy the tickets. But yes, I really do want to go, actually. You know, I'm from Savannah, Georgia, so it's a short drive to Jacksonville, and I could go visit my dad at the same time. So yeah. I'm planning to join you.
Oh, good. Okay. It's an absolute love fest. It is so special. And I think we have over 300 breast cancer patients and survivors run. And we have plenty of oncologists who breast cancer doctors and oncologists come in. It's very special. Donna Deegan is a force, and her race director, Amanda Napolitano, does such a wonderful job with these events. So I'm excited. I'm hopeful you'll take the plunge and join us. It'll be
so much fun. Yes, I'm planning to. I just need to, and I want to rope in some of my colleagues to join me too, because I think they'd love it too.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, Dr. Amy Commander, I love you so much.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure to join you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And now tell everybody to get to work.
Right. Absolutely. I agree.
Hi, this is Rudy Novotny, the voice of America's Marathons. We all love how much running has benefited every aspect of our lives, so much so that most of us only wish we'd started sooner. Wouldn't it be wonderful to give the opportunity to children of today? Well, you can. The Morning Mile is a before-school walking and running program that gives children the chance to start each day in an active way while enjoying fun, music, and friends. That's every child, every day. It's also supported by a wonderful system of rewards, which keeps students highly motivated and frequently congratulated. Created by our favorite fitness expert, Fitz Kohler, Morning Milers across the country have run over 2 million miles and are having greater success with academics, behavior, and sports because of it. The Morning Mile is free to the child, free to the school, and is inexpensively funded by businesses or generous individuals. Help more kids get moving in the morning by visiting morningmile.com. Champion the program at your favorite school or find out more about sponsorship opportunities. That's morningmile.com. Long may you run.